Welcome to the Home of Medicine with me, Dr. Amy Bearbridge.
And me, Dr. Ben Lovell.
So, Ben, thank you for joining me again today. I am going to talk you through a case.
I'm very excited. Go ahead.
Okay, so I'm going to set the scene. I always like to set the scene. It's a Sunday. I seem to do a lot of Sundays, but I guess that's what happens in acute medicine. You work a lot of weekends. And I was doing a post-take ward round. And this was about 6 or 7 months ago, and it was actually a post-take ward round of this particular individual, in that he'd already been seen the day before by a consultant on the team and had actually been seen the day before that. So there's already a lot of notes being made, a lot of diagnoses being made, a lot of investigations undertaken, and he'd been started on treatment. So I picked the notes up and I looked at them and I was like, oh, wow, this looks complicated. This is going to be quite far too complicated for me on a Sunday morning. I'm going to really need to sit down and have a think about this. So I had a very quick scan through the notes. And what I identified is that this individual, who was in his early 30s, had actually been unwell for around 4 months. And when I first saw him on this Sunday morning, he said that the symptoms had been on and off for 4 months, but were getting worse. And I noted in the documentation that he'd been admitted in March and April. He'd actually been transferred to a tertiary hospital for further investigations, still awaiting a definitive diagnosis. And then he was discharged, not really on any treatment for anything. And then he'd presented again in June of this year with exactly the same symptoms. So I went to see him and he was sat there in bed, lying down, looked exhausted, didn't look very well. He looked a bit like he had the flu. So, you know, when somebody's lying in bed, they're really tired, just exhausted, too tired to eat really, just looking at the light hurts the eyes a little bit, just generally looked ill. And I couldn't really put my finger on it, but he looked like somebody who'd been ill for a while. So it didn't look like an acute illness. It looked like he'd been unwell for a few months and was having a bit of an episode of whatever the illness was. So I said to him, take me back, way back to March. Tell me what went on in March. And then he said, well, it was exactly the same as happened this week. I keep getting a fever and this fever is relentless. It goes up. It's really, really high. I check it at home. It's over 40 degrees. And I feel awful. I'm really, really sweaty, but I feel cold at the same time. And I feel absolutely exhausted when it happens. So in between the fever and the sweats, actually, I don't feel that bad. And actually, I might have a couple of weeks of feeling good. But for the last month or so, the fever had been increasing in frequency, the sweats had, and he was so fatigued by it that he couldn't work. And he actually said that his whole body was aching and he just felt absolutely exhausted. He couldn't work. He was exhausted. He had this fever. He then said that he'd lost a little bit of weight. He didn't know how much, but his clothes felt a little bit baggy. And the sweats that he'd been getting with a fever, he'd also started to notice some sweats at night. So I started to panic then, thinking night sweats, weight loss, fever. This is something pretty serious. Have we missed something on his previous admission? What are your thoughts so far?
So when a patient comes to me and they've got a long-term history of recurrent documented fevers, which is different to recurrent hot flashes or feeling hot, documented fevers, then I think three systems. I think, is this an infectious cause, some kind of chronic infection? So I need to take a full infectious history, travel, you name it. I think, is this a hematological cause? Has he got some kind of new onset lymphoma, for example? And I'd be asking a lot of questions about that and looking very closely for lymphadenopathy and looking at his cell count. And then I think, is it a rheumatological cause? Has he got undiagnosed recurrent inflammatory condition, like familial Mediterranean fever or something that can cause recurrent bouts of fever? So I'll be thinking about his family history, ethnicity, examining him head to toe, looking at his skin and his joints, and doing a full blood panel, looking at an autoantibody screen. So yeah, hematological, rheumatological infection screen will be my first three prongs of attack in a patient like this.
Yeah, brilliant. I completely agree. And actually, what was interesting is this gentleman had been discussed in the morning handover because it was an unusual case. And I was like, this is FMF. You know, it's obviously this is FMF. Thinking, I must sound really stupid, you know, really clever. I've got the diagnosis by a few little things. And, you know, obviously, by me saying that, it clearly wasn't familial Mediterranean fever. But, you know, I was starting to think, well, it's been going on for a while. Exactly like you say, the documented fevers were there. And I absolutely, infection, hematological, and rheumatological. So, infection causes, you know, they're common. And I sort of went down the route of asking him, you know, any recent travel, any, what's your sexual history like, any unprotected sex recently? And had he been exposed to anybody else who'd had any infectious illnesses? Was there any diarrhea, vomiting, coughs, colds? You name it, I asked him, and he didn't have any of those infective symptoms and no recent travel. So hematology. So he'd lost some weight. He was fatigued. He'd had night sweats and some fevers. So yes, this could be a hematological condition, was my thinking. And I'd noticed that actually he'd had two CT taps. Two CT thorax, abdomen, and pelvis, because remember, this was about his fourth admission into hospital. And on these CT scans, it had been documented splenomegaly, hepatomegaly, and a
Ooh.
very big spleen as well.
A very
And
big what,
one
sorry?
very big spleen. So it
Right.
wasn't just like a moderate splenomegaly, it was huge spleen. And actually, he had widespread lymphadenopathy throughout. So does that change your thought process, or are you starting to think down one particular road?
So my money now goes on a heme condition, but it could still be any of the three. It could still be any of the three. So widespread reactive lymphadenopathy and hepatosplenomegaly, you could get in some infectious conditions and in some rheumatological conditions, but this man's immune system seems to be activated and unwell.
Yes.
I think at this point in time, well, we haven't discussed the blood work yet, but in terms of planning ahead, I'm thinking, are we going to end up biopsying one of those big lymph nodes? Or doing a PET scan and seeing what lights up and what doesn't. But basics first.
Now, interestingly, you mentioned a PET scan. Now, I know I was skipping the blood seed, but he had a PET scan as well. And he'd had a PET scan when he was admitted to the tertiary centre a couple of weeks before he'd been represented. And the PET scan, again, didn't show anything particular, apart from no particular activity, apart from there were lymph nodes and there was a spleen and there was a liver.
Okay.
But it didn't really highlight anything else. So he'd been sent over from the District General Hospital to the tertiary centre to the infectious diseases team. So I think this is where the first bias comes into this case, is when you are referred to an infectious diseases team, your mind automatically thinks this is an infectious disease because you are now under the care of an infectious disease team. And he'd had lots of investigations. So the thought process now was, is this TB? Could be. Could this be lymphoma, like you've already mentioned? Yes, it could be. Absolutely. Could this be Epstein-Barr virus? Hepatosplenomegaly, fever? Could be. Could it be HIV? So again, there's still lots of unanswered questions here. And actually, TB tests came negative, HIV was negative, and he was awaiting a biopsy of his lymph nodes.
I think the only thing from just thinking out loud, the infectious diseases angle, EBV is a good shout actually, but why was it relapsing remitting? You said he feels pretty okay in between episodes, and EBV doesn't behave like that. So that just pushes me slightly away from that. I don't know what the outcome of this is going to be, but my honest reaction is, if it is infectious, why is it swinging back and forth?
Yeah, I mean,
Got
malaria
weird
does
travel history,
that.
right? Is he a British guy, a born and raised white, no travel?
So, a little bit further information then. He was an Asian gentleman, but had been born and raised in the UK and had no travel. abroad recently. So when I, you know, I took more of a history and basically kept reiterating the fever, the night sweats, the weight loss, and I asked him about his joints because, like you, I started to think, oh, could this be rheumatological? And he said, my whole body aches, my hands, my wrists, my shoulders, my knees, my whole body is just aching. And it was like his muscles were tender, everything was just aching, and it like sort of like flu-like symptoms. So nothing really specific. So I examined him. And on examination, I felt his pulse, and his pulse was 120 beats per minute. So he's pretty sporting. His blood pressure was 110 over 70. So actually pretty near perfect. And his temperature was 39.7. And I was like, this is interesting. So I looked back on his temperature chart, and he had fluctuating temperatures. So he had moments of normal temperature, 36, 37. And then occasionally he'd go up to 39, 40 degrees, and it go back to normal. Now, I thought this could have been paracetamol response. He was given antipyretics, potentially. His oxygen saturations were 97% on air, and his respiratory rate was 18. So that wasn't too bad. So apart from this tachycardia and obviously the very high temperature that he had, on examination, his heart sounds were normal. So this wasn't like an endocarditic picture. There was no heart valves that I could, there was no murmurs I could hear. Felt his abdomen. And I always find it really difficult to palpate a spleen, but I could feel his spleen. It was very enlarged. I was coming right from the right upper quadrant, right the way down onto the left-hand side. And I could also feel his, sorry, left upper quadrant. I've got my sides wrong. No, that's right. Yeah, left upper quadrant spleen going all the way down to the right-hand side. And his liver was enlarged as well. His face looked a little bit puffy, but not too bad. I couldn't see anything in the mouth. He had lymph nodes everywhere. Cervical lymphadenopathy, axillary lymphadenopathy, groin lymphadenopathy. So there was just lymph nodes everywhere. And I looked at his skin and I thought, oh, his skin looks a bit red and patchy, almost like eczematous. So I said to him, how long have you had this rash for? And he said, oh, it's not a rash. I've just got itchy skin. I've had dry skin for about 6 months. Okay, so similar time frame. So I fully examined him all over, and he had this itchy rash, circular rash all over his back, on his arms, nothing on his face, but it was on his legs as well. It was difficult to identify the colour, but it looked quite reddy and did look very dry. So I thought, okay, is this linked? Probably not. Could this be a bit of eczema? Could he have had some allergy to something? Not sure what's going on. So I sat down after I'd fully examined him. I looked at his joints as well. There was no, his, and his hands, it looked like he had some active synovitis at his metacarpal phalangeal joints and his wrist. And I was like, but now I'm thinking, am I imagining this? You know, because then I'm starting to think, ooh, this could be rheumatological because he's got, you know, his joints. And then I start to think, am I now putting diagnoses in my head and finding the signs that fit the diagnosis that I think is going on? Then I start to drive myself mad. And by this point, I did not know what was going on. So after I'd examined him and I'd taken the history, I said to him, which I do sometimes, you've given me a lot of information. I'm going to go and sit down now. And I'm going to have a look at everything you've given me. I'm going to look at all the investigations that you've given me. And I'm going to try and figure out what is going on. So that's what I did. And I think he looked at me as if to go, what is she talking about? But I just couldn't figure it out in my head. So I wrote everything down. And I wrote notes. And my diagnosis, and I was trying to think of diagnoses, ruling in, ruling out, what investigations I wanted to do. And I looked through all of the investigations that he had done and wrote them all down, looked at his observation chart, and then tried to fit the pieces together. Any thoughts at this time?
No. Well, I don't feel too bad not knowing, because you tell me that the tertiary specialist didn't know either, so that takes the heat off.
Yeah.
So he's got massive, would you say massive splenomegaly, or am I over-egging it?
Yeah, you know, well, absolutely. I think it was about 24 centimetres. Was documented on the
massive splenomegaly. For me, from my memory, are coming up with myeloproliferative disorders like
yes,
I'm thinking myelofibrosis. I'm thinking rarer things like visceral leishmaniasis. But to give you that,
That's on my list.
oh, is
Yeah.
it? It's just that's a little connection from way back in the my PACES days as cause of massive pustular. And I guess EBV as well can do it in more
Yeah.
of the acute phase. The skin reaction, is it paraneoplastic? Is he got a has he got a hematological diagnosis and this is a paraneoplastic eruption? Or is it part of a rheumatological disorder which has given him multi-system inflammation? Was his inflammatory markers doing anything interesting during these acute attacks? Is CRP white cells, lymphocytes, anything exciting there?
So I'm going to give you a bit more to the puzzle. So I'm now going to give you, because this is the way I went in to see him, is I didn't look at too much information, because I sometimes find if I go to see a complicated patient like this and I go with too much information, I'm very biased about what's going on. So I'd saw that he'd seen infectious diseases team, I'd been admitted under them at tertiary hospital, but I didn't look too much further into it, because then I sometimes find that that biases my diagnosis a little bit. So I didn't look too much at what was going on, but I'm going to tell you now about some investigations that he had had done. So basic investigations is CRP was 284. ESR was 125.
Okay.
CT abdomen, as I'd mentioned before, had splenomegaly, and he had widespread lymph nodes as well. He'd also had a TB culture, which was negative, rheumatoid factor, negative, anti-nuclear antibody, negative, blood cultures, negative, respiratory cultures, negative, QuantiFERON TB test, negative, serum angiotensin converting enzyme, negative, varicella zoster, negative, CMV, negative, EBV, negative, HIV, negative. He'd also had a lymph node biopsy, which showed non-necrotizing granulomatous inflammation.
Right.
And he also had a secrete an IgA level, which was high.
Okay. I'm there's
So,
no more from that lymph node biopsy, no more immunohistochemistry staining or anything of that flavor, no?
there was no malignancy found.
Okay.
So there was no anything that would suggest a lymphoma, and he'd actually been referred to the hematologists and was due to have a further lymph node biopsy. Because of the widespread lymph nodes and the fevers and the weight loss and these type B symptoms suggestive of lymphoma, even though the initial lymph node biopsy was negative, the thought process was, we must do another one, because actually, have we missed a lymphoma somewhere? So yeah, absolutely, potentially. However, he'd had lots of investigations done, and as you can see, we'd excluded a lot of infections and a lot of malignancies. Really, he did have a very high white cell count and a neutrophilia as well, although, you know, these did settle when he didn't have the fever. His kidneys were absolutely normal. His liver function was normal. Clotting was normal. Everything was fine. So I sat down and wrote this list. And I'm really old fashioned, and I still write on paper. And I wrote like a spider diagram. And I wrote, 33-year-old gentleman with these symptoms, with this temperature. And I went, oh, I know what he's got. And I turned around to the SHO and I said, I know what he's got. And she went, no, you don't. I said, I think I do. And I think I'm going to give him something today, and I think he'll feel better tomorrow. And she went, no. I was like, yeah. And I felt like I'd had a moment of like house, that I was like, if I've got this right, I'm going to feel like a genius. And now I often on this podcast get things wrong. I know I get things wrong. I make mistakes all the time. But you know what? I was bang on with this case, and I feel
Oh,
really proud.
I'm so excited.
I've probably got listeners going, what is it? What is it? So I'll give you one. So I went back and looked at his blood tests, and I looked at his ferritin.
Okay, yeah, and it was very
Ferritin was 1,567. Obviously, normal's about 150, 200 max. So I said, he's got fever. He's got this arthralgia. Okay. He's got a rash.
Yeah.
He's got these raised white cell counts, splenomegaly and lymph nodes, negative rheumatoid factor and ANA.
Yeah.
This is adult onset Still's
Still
disease.
disease. Well done.
So Even talking about it now, I'm like, I can't believe I got it. You know, sometimes you just sit down and you write it down, and I think that's the beauty of taking the time. And actually, even in acute medicine, even when it's busy, we actually do still make good diagnoses sometimes, actually, and get to the bottom of this. And when I went back into him about an hour later, and I said, I think I know what's wrong with you. And he was like, no, you can't possibly know what's wrong with me. And I was like, I do. I think I know what it is. And I'm going to give you 60 milligrams of prednisolone, which is steroids. I'm going to give you some antacid medication because it sometimes can irritate your tummy. And I think you'll feel better tomorrow. And he was like, no, don't believe you. And I was like, I'm going to come and find you tomorrow and I bet you'll feel better. And I gave him 60 milligrams of steroids. And I went to see him the next day. And he was like, what's your name? I was like, why is that? Because I need to write to the hospital because I feel better. And I was like, you can't feel better that quickly. And he was like, I do. He hadn't had a temperature spike since. Absolutely nothing. So that's not the end of the story, though. So, yes, I did think this was adult onset Still's disease. Yes, he improved with the steroids, which was really good. And I had to chat to the family. And eventually, we got a rheumatological consult to come and see him. And they said, yes, this is could be adult onset Still's disease. He fits all of those criteria. However, this could still be lymphoma, so you might not be right. So even in the face of all that positive investigations, he still went on and had further lymph node biopsies to rule out lymphoma, even though he'd already had one to rule it out. And somebody said to me, how can you get that? How did you get that diagnosis? And I was like, well, why wouldn't I? And they were like, well, he's been seen already by rheumatology and he's been seen by infectious diseases. So why should you be right? And I thought that was really interesting because I sometimes feel as acute physicians, we don't get the respect that we deserve, actually. And we're still highly trained physicians, general physicians. And because we see so many people all day, every day, that are non-selected. So I'm not seeing all respiratory cases or gastro or rheumatology. I'm seeing a wide variety. The number of patients I see and the number of illness scripts I have in my head to go back to and reflect on, I've got a lot of information there. So I'm just as likely to make a diagnosis as anybody else.
Well, you don't have to convince me. I mean, I think we both have been champions for general medicine for a long time, and general internal medicine is not, well, it isn't popular. People like to focus on an organ or a system, and good luck to them. That's brilliant that they found their niche in life, but this is our niche. And I think, you know, if you really dislike doing general medicine, that's completely valid and okay, but you can't disrespect it and say that they aren't good enough, physicians who do gen med or acute med, because we haven't got our own focus. Our focus is broad, and I think there is a common sort of stereotype that, oh, gen med is all about breadth but not really depth. It's about broad brushstrokes, not fine detail. And you know what? Sometimes that's true, but sometimes it isn't. And sometimes we do, and we can hyper focus in one area and pull together with our years and years of training to focus on one area just because they came in through a general medical pathway and saw a general medical physician. I completely agree. It doesn't mean that, oh, but they didn't see an organ, a system specialist, an ologist, so they didn't get the right treatment. We need to work together. And I do simulate training where I work, and one of my ground rules, and we do our sim sessions, we do our scenarios, is let's not reinforce stereotypes here. I think they're really harmful to MDT working. And I know we like to have a joke and say, oh, that's typical of that particular group. Anaesthetists are like this. Orthopods are like this. But I say here, when we're doing an educational day, we're going to make an assumption that everyone is coming to do a good job and everyone wants to do a good job. And I think that's a really useful basic assumption to make and a starting point to make. And that even includes us crazy folk who have chosen the life of gen med because we love it. We love it. We love the variety.
Exactly.
And I respect you, respect me maybe in return, and then we can give really good patient care.
And what it reinforced, I guess, in me is, again, I love general medicine, but actually, I was looking at this case with a completely fresh pair of eyes. And because I'm a general physician, I have no bias towards this must be an infectious disease because it was referred to me as an infectious disease. This must be a malignancy because it was referred to me as malignancy. I can take a step back with complete fresh eyes and go, Let's go way back to the beginning. Let's write everything out that we know. Let's write everything out that we know that's definitely negative. We know that's definitely positive. And I wrote a whole sheet to send to the rheumatology team saying, this is my reasoning behind the diagnosis of adult onset Still's disease. There's no infective agent found. There's no malignancy found. There's no lymphoma found. There's no sarcoid found. He's had numerous investigations since March. He's got a very high ferritin, a very high CRP, very high ESR. He's got splenomegaly on his abdomen, widespread lymph nodes. And then I even documented the Yamaguchi criteria, which is the diagnostic criterion for adult onset Still's disease. And he had the major criteria. He had arthralgia, fever more than 39 degrees that often fluctuates in his diurnal during the day. He had a rash. So this rash that he'd noticed for 6 months that he said was itchy, when he looked closer, actually, it was quite typical of the Still's rash that you get, this salmon-coloured maculopapular rash. However, because he had Asian skin, it was very difficult to exactly say that this was salmon coloured. He'd also had this raised white cell count, and he had the minor criteria of splenomegaly and lymph nodes. So, really interesting case, actually. But I found myself having to sell the diagnosis because I didn't feel that I was good enough to make that diagnosis. And I know that sounds crazy, but that was my thought process. And brilliantly for the patient, actually, he does have Still's disease. He's on steroids. He's now gone on to disease modifying drugs. He's on methotrexate. He's doing really well. And occasionally he gets a bit of a fever, but nothing consistent. And his life is completely changed for the better now. He's able to work again because of that diagnosis. And it was just a really interesting case for many, many reasons, I think.
And that must generate a lot of job satisfaction for you.
Yeah, it did actually. And it does still, it's nice to get when you get things right because I often feel like I get things wrong a lot. So when you do get something right, it's really satisfying. But I guess seeing the response in the patient and how much better he was is really satisfying because that, I guess, is life-changing. He did make a big difference in him. And actually, it wasn't that difficult a diagnosis to make in the way that right back at the beginning, you said this is infective, hematological, and rheumatological. You got it. You were there. And then it's just about saying which one of those it is. And actually, when you write it out, you can search Google. And if you put these symptoms into Google, one of the first things that comes up is adult onset Still's disease.
And this is why we're all going to be replaced with AI in a few years down the line. Until that day comes, then diagnostic skills are key.
Yeah,
I think.
absolutely. It's still all about the patient interaction.
Remember when you signed up for medicine when you were a little sixth former or whatever, you were doing your GCSEs and you wanted to be a doctor and you kind of thought this is what you'd be doing all the whole time and that you find out it's not that, but it's still there. And I think it's a shame, and I don't invalidate the current feeling that there's a lot of negatives about being a doctor in the UK today, but you go on social media, the overwhelming rhetoric is we all understand this is the worst job in the world, right? Yep, that's a given. And that seems to be where we're working from. And I think it's important to maintain, why I brought it up, job pleasure, job satisfaction, a good day, a good win when we have them, and record them in our memories and say them out loud and speak them to each other. Because I think it's good not just for internal morale, but for like system-wide morale and remembering that we are doing a really good job some of the time. And it is negative, and there are some really cool stuff going on. And making a really good diagnosis, that's a very strong satisfaction, I think, in a
Yeah,
lot of.
it feels good, and it still feels good to know that I've really made a difference. And you're absolutely right. We often talk, we have reflective sessions, we have peer-to-peer learning, but we only learn from our mistakes. But actually, there's something to learn about from this in that I didn't make a mistake, but what I did do is made a good diagnosis, and this is how I made it. And it wasn't anything clever. It was just me sitting down, going back to basics and writing everything out and going, it could be this, it could be that.
There are power in our losses and power in our wins. I'm quoting Sophie
Absolutely.
now.
We need to celebrate our wins more often.
One other little point you made, which I think is really important, is when we look at descriptions, particularly when we're looking for skin eruptions, is that they were all described in what they look like in white people. And if you're looking for a salmon colored is what I remember for stills. You're looking for that salmon colored rash. You're not going to see it in a person of color, which is most humans in the world. And it's interesting that we still are describing what it looks like on pale skin. And I can think of quite a few conditions where there's a description, even things like the malar flushing of mitral valve disease and things like that. They're all described as they apply to white skin. And we need to remember that we cannot use those applications if the patient doesn't have white skin. And we need to have better understanding of how these present in darker skin tones, which even when I was reading medical textbooks and I was learning, wasn't really available to learn. I think now we are seeing more medical educational tools when you are at medical school, which shows you what skin eruptions look like on different skin tones, which is great. But I think we need to keep that in our minds that when we're not always, if we're not examining a person who is white, we cannot look for those traditional skin eruptions which have been described in white skin. And if we miss them, we might miss the diagnosis. So that's an important, like an open-minded approach is one thing I just thought about now when you were telling me about this patient.
Yeah, absolutely. And what had been interesting is he'd actually been seen by the dermatology team who said it was eczema. And I think that's why I thought it was probably eczema initially. And you're right, it is really difficult sometimes to pick up rashes on different coloured skin because textbooks, you're right, when you look at a salmon coloured rash of adult onset Still's disease, it is when you look at the pictures, when you look online, it's only on white skin. That's not helpful at all.
Even basic things like the VIP scores for cannulas, you know, they describe how they look on white skin, and we can't be missing infected cannulas on people of color because we don't know how to identify it on white skin. That's crazy. So it's an important bias since we're talking about bias.
It is absolutely. What we also talked about as well is we talked about splenomegaly in our PACES because that's one thing that we when we do our MRCP exam, and I reckon you were thinking about the same thing as me. There's a really good acronym, Mix Blips and Charms, and they are the causes of splenomegaly.
Spell it out for me.
So the first one is charms, and that's small splenomegaly, so it's charms. Collagen vascular disease is C. H is hyperthyroidism. A is amyloidosis. R is rheumatoid disease, in particular Felty syndrome, which is rheumatoid arthritis, splenomegaly, and neutropenia. M is many systemic infections, such as TB. I know it's a bit of a. And then S is sarcoidosis.
Mycobacteria for M. You could have said mycobacteria for M, and that would have been T.
Ooh,
Okay, but me.
that's a good one.
Sorry to
And
interrupt.
then you've got BLIPS, which is medium causes, and BLIPS B is blood disorders such as leukemias, hemolytic anemias. Then L is lymphoma. I is infection, such as malaria, Epstein-Barr virus, sepsis.
HIV.
P is for portal hypertension. And S is for storage disorders such as Gaucher's disease.
Limonek. Well, Goucher's 1, 2, or 3, Amy, or all three.
Well, it doesn't specify it. I don't think I've ever seen one. But and then large is mix. So M is for myelofibrosis. I is for idiopathic tropical splenomegaly. So this is our visceral leishmaniasis. C is chronic myeloid leukemia. K, and I never forget, this is for Kala-Azar, which is
Sounds
a
good.
parasitic infection, and S is for schistosomiasis.
Gotcha. Charms, blips, mix. Okay, I've written them down.
So there's a good teaching point when you, yeah.
There's my CPD for the week. Fantastic.
There's your CPD for me, absolutely. So any key take-home points for yourself on from that discussion, Ben?
Well, I think clinical and non-clinical. Clinical is always nice to remind myself of a rare but important condition like adult onset Still's disease. And when you said ferritin, finally the last little synapse fired, but it's good to keep those synapse firing and practicing. And I love these acronyms, CHARMS, BLIPS, and MICS, which I've written down on a bit of paper here. Non-clinical pearls is, I think it's working out when you need to make an investment in a patient in terms of time. Time being such a precious resource for an acute physician, it is like gold and silver and platinum. It's so limited, we can't spend that much. So working out when you're going to spend time on one particular patient so you don't sacrifice efficiency. It doesn't mean that other patients get the short thrift. It doesn't mean that you're doing a ward round till 9 p.m. But working out when you do need to make that investment in a patient and when you're going to get a good return on that investment, if I can just stretch that metaphor to death. I thought that was a really nice example of that.
Yeah, I agree. Actually, one of the skills I think I'm still not very good at is deciding how long to spend with a patient. And particular thing happened at work on Wednesday this week when I ended up spending 90 minutes with a particular patient, and it was nothing that was really medical that I was doing. I wasn't necessarily taking a history or examining, but what I was doing was the right thing for that patient at that time. And made a difference to that patient's pathway through the hospital. So although it was a huge amount of time, for me, it was time well spent. And I think you're absolutely right about time and recognizing who needs it and who maybe doesn't need as much.
Yeah, and just being careful and open-minded with it. You may say, okay, this next patient has pneumonia, easy peasy, oxygen, antibiotic fluids. And that probably works for 99 pneumonias, but every 100th pneumonia, they've got lung cancer, and you're going to miss it if you spend 4 minutes at the bedside. So it's just trying to be open-minded and cognizant, metacognizant of the patients that you're seeing and when you can afford to be super turbo speed and when you need to slow down. And that is tricky.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much to everybody for listening to these podcasts. If you are really enjoying it, please rate, review, and share with all of your friends. And we will be back soon. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to the Home of Medicine podcast, a podcast brought to you by the EFIM Academy in association with the European Federation of Internal Medicine, a leading organisation in internal medicine. Thanks for listening.